When Robert Perry sought the pole, and even before that, when he was exploring the jungles of Nicaragua, he did not do so alone. With him was a man named Matthew Hinson, who took the risks with Perry, but enjoyed none of the glory for over 75 years after his accomplishments. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. Today on Conversations, the recognition of Matthew Hinson. With me is Dr. Alan Counter, who has helped the United States come to terms with and acknowledge the accomplishments of this man. I'm Susan McInnes. I hope you'll join us in conversation with Dr. Alan Counter. Alan, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
I want to ask you, and it may seem odd just at the beginning, at first about your grandmother. You have said that Matthew Hinson was a childhood hero of yours, mm-hmm. and that you've held him as something of a hero for all of your life, but that you wouldn't have except for your grandmother. Tell me why.
Well, probably because grandmothers, in most cases, pass on wisdom to you in addition to knowledge. And my grandmother was one of those people. Like most grandmothers, she liked to talk to her grandson about the world and give him her image of the world. And she was very proud of being a woman who was really African-American, but part Native American Indian. And she would talk about all the contributions that people made to society who had been overlooked. And whenever you mentioned the North Pole and you'd come home from school and say your school book said that a man named Mr. Perry discovered it, she'd remind you very quickly, well, he may have discovered it, but there was also another man who discovered it with him, and he was a black man, and his name was Matthew Hinson. And that made all of us kids very proud, and I think she was quite typical of a number of grandmothers who would do that sort of thing to make the young people feel some sense of pride.
Mm-hmm. What did she tell you about Matthew Hinson?
Well, she simply knew that he had been a part of the expedition. She certainly didn't know all of the details, but she had heard as a young woman that Matthew Hinson had been there to put the American flag at the top of the earth, mm-hmm. and that he had literally carried Perry there. That was her image. But of course, it was hard for me to know that, because naturally my grandmother, with her pride, might tend to exaggerate it in favor of someone that she respected very much. But sure enough, she was absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Dr. Alan Counter, and this is Conversations. Welcome, and join us, please. Tell us about Matthew Hinson. So many people won't know who this man was. He was born in the mid-1800s.
Yes, he was born in 1866 in Charles County, Maryland, on a farm there. And he was born to a father who was a very active farmer on land that was owned by non-African Americans, but he simply worked that land. He had the right to do that. And his mother was there as a farmer as well. They had six children. And his father died of what appears to be a heart attack, and left him there with his mother on the farm. They moved to Washington, D.C., where he stayed with an uncle. And it was there that he attended school to the sixth grade, which was not uncommon for kids at that time. To make it to sixth grade was quite an achievement. They'd learned to count, to read, and so forth, and they could pretty much make it on their own. He went out to seek a job. And in so doing, was able to make contact with a sailor, a ship's captain who was of Quaker background, and he managed to get a job on board the ship as a cabin boy, it was called. And he managed to travel with this man. This Quaker took an interest in him and taught him the classics. He taught him mathematics, taught him some navigation, and taught him the Bible. And Hinson was always very proud of that. When this captain died some 5 years later, Hinson returned to the United States and started searching for jobs. And he landed a job because of his experience and his ability to express himself with people. He landed a job at a place called Stinnemetz & Sons in Washington, D.C., where he was handling furs. He was storing them, he was keeping records, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And this was the young Matthew Hinson.
What were the prospects of for a young black boy without connections and money at that time? I'm trying to get a picture of what Matthew Hinson's life might have been like, perhaps without the luck of running into that captain who sponsored him.
Well, it was rather difficult. I mean, 1866, the time of his birth, was right outside of slavery, just after the Emancipation Proclamation. And most of the black people around the D.C. area and the Charles County, Maryland area, which is about 30 miles from Washington proper, most of the young people worked on farms. And that was the only opportunity available for him. Otherwise, he would have to become a servant. But he actually found a job washing dishes in a little black restaurant where some of the men who sail up and down or travel up and down the Potomac would stop in for food. And it was there that he met people who talked about sailing, which developed an interest in this young kid about going to sea. But there were very few opportunities. Some people worked the Potomac, others farmed, and there was little in the way of jobs. Now, when he returned to America after going out to sea, it was still very difficult to find a job. But it was here that he found this job that changed his life, because a young Navy lieutenant walked into the office one day and started talking with him and was just amazed to meet this young man who had more seagoing experience than he had, and he was a Navy lieutenant. That was young Lieutenant Robert Peary.
Were they about the same age?
Peary was 10 years older.
Older.
Yes. Right. Peary was 10 years older and had graduated from Bowdoin College in Maine, had joined the Navy pretty much as a draftsman and then a surveyor. And they got together, and he liked Hinson very much, and he invited Hinson to travel to Nicaragua with him. Now, there was more to Hinson's going to Nicaragua with him than just being a servant, as Peary tries to point out. Peary also hired hundreds of men from Jamaica to become a part of that project, that survey project in Nicaragua, where we were considering building the first canal. It later became the Panama Canal, as you know, but at that time they were considering Nicaragua. So Hinson went along with hundreds of other black people from Jamaica and the Caribbean islands, but he was special to Peary because of his intelligence, because of his abilities. And that's when that relationship started.
Also a facility with languages, as we're going to find out later, but that this was also valuable in Nicaragua?
Well, Hinson had learned to speak a little Spanish. Mm-hmm. He could speak some Japanese. He had traveled to China. He could even speak some Russian. And he had this knack for languages. And it was just amazing. And Peary kept writing about him. He would say, this young Negro man, he has greater than average intelligence and a great deal of pluck, which was his word he would use. So he was impressed with this young black man.
Have you reflected in the years you've been learning about Matthew Hinson on what he might be today if he was born in your generation and mine, or perhaps in your daughter's generation?
Well, I'll tell you, there's no question about it. Today, that man, with his drive and his determination, he would certainly be head of some university. Mm. I think he really had an interest in scholarship. He always tried to read. All of his writings kept saying, I'd like to learn more mathematics. I'd love to learn this. And he was just continually trying to learn. Or he'd be the head of a corporation. He had a real determination. Imagine traveling up to Greenland all of these years, over 18 years, going back and forth with Peary. And even Mrs. Robert Peary said when everybody else abandoned her husband, the only person to stand with him was Matthew Hinson. So I think he would have achieved quite a bit. He was obviously limited by his circumstances at the time. And he later received, after the North Pole discovery, an honorary master's degree from Howard University, which was the highest they could give, an honorary master's from Morgan State College in Maryland, another black school, which was the highest they could give. He wanted to be lettered, but he never had the opportunity to really go to school. Mm-hmm. But he was still a man who was capable of writing letters. I read his letters as early as 1888 to Admiral Peary. They were quite clear, you know, quite intelligent, and they spoke of a man who really had a great deal of sensitivity and knowledge.
Did he write about his trips to the pole? It seems to me I've heard somewhere that there is a book mm-hmm. authored by Matthew Hinson. Is that right?
There is a book authored by Matthew Hinson. It's called Now Black Explorer at the North Pole. It's been reissued in paperback.
Oh,
but
good.
The original term was Negro Explorer at the North Pole, in keeping with the times. It was the only book that Peary permitted any of his explorers to write. He refused to let any of his white explorers write. He was very concerned about having competition and that there might be something to compete with his efforts. And I think one of the reasons, he claims, of course, that the reason he let Hinson do this was because he felt strongly about Hinson, Hinson had helped him, and so forth. That's probably partly true. The other reason was that, imagine, in 1912, when this book was issued, there was not a white reading public that was interested in a black book that often. So he felt that there was nothing Hinson could do that could at all challenge him or would cross over into the white world. And the two worlds evolved about each other like two separate planets. There was the black world and there was the white world. And so Peary assumed that this book could be released and probably nobody white would ever see it, frankly. And so it was for that reason he permitted Hinson to write this book. It was a brief account, not a very extensive account, mentioning his early upbringing. I think a lot was edited out. It had to pass Peary and his approval before it was released. And I could sense from studying the men and their archives, their letters, and these books, that much had been taken out.
We're talking today with Dr. Alan Counter, and we're talking about the recognition of Matthew Hinson. Our topic is the North Pole, the ascents made on it, and the opinions that were had about the pole following those ascents. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I'll introduce you a bit to Dr. Alan Counter. He was brought to the University of Alaska Fairbanks in a project sponsored by the Northern Studies Program, by the Special Events Lecture Series, and the Statewide Affirmative Action and Equal Opportunity Office. He has been giving lectures around Fairbanks during the week that he is here and has spoken to, we think, slightly under 3,000 people, or perhaps slightly over that many. If you haven't had an opportunity to see Dr. Counter while he was in Fairbanks, this is your opportunity to listen to this story. Dr. Alan Counter is a professor of neuroscience at Harvard University and also a neurophysicist at Massachusetts General Hospital as well as at Harvard. This is Conversations. Sketch for me, if you will, the story of the pole. It is a many people sought the pole. Many people failed. Some got as close as 130 miles to it and couldn't go on and went away. Some claimed the pole but never made it. And some were believed and others not believed, including Perry. Mm-hmm. This is a very complicated story. It is not just Matthew Henson who provides complexity to the story of the pole, but it is the whole universe of the pole itself that is a complex social problem.
Yes, it is. It's a very captivating story. I mean, it's one that you can just carry on forever in terms of general understanding and exploration of the topic. Once one immerses oneself in this topic, it's hard to even let go because there's so much about it that you can just get caught up in. And sometimes I've wondered why I permitted myself to do that. But it's so fascinating that I've been told by authorities that people from age 12 to 112 just love this topic. You must remember that at the turn of the century, the North Pole was as distant to most people in the world as the moon. And in fact, reaching the North Pole was tantamount in some ways to reaching the moon in the minds of most people. There were many different myths about reaching the North Pole. They felt in general that there was a great vortex there that would draw people down into the center of the Earth. Some scientists believe that. Other writers felt that there were large concentric circles there and that were big holes at the top of the Earth and people actually lived there. And that some of their the flumes that coming from the people burning trees down in the center of the Earth created the Aurora Borealis and all sorts of myths about this, and no one really knew. But there were those who really felt that it might be a very quick way across the top of the Earth to Asia for trade routes. Others felt it had military significance. So there are all sorts of reasons that people from Italy, like the Duke d'Abruzzi and others, were trying to reach the North Pole first. Many of them went farther north than Peary initially. Then there were people from Norway, from Denmark, from Sweden, from Russia, all trying to reach the North Pole. And it was realized that whoever reached it could claim it pretty much in the name of their nation. Our leaders and the people trying to reach the North Pole, the ones who had been sponsored primarily by our government and otherwise, were mainly Peary. There were a couple of other people, such as Greeley and others, who tried to reach it, but Peary was the main person. He named it his route as he went up toward the Greenland coast. He named the polar Eskimos in that area his Eskimos, he called them. And he put all of this in his book. And I could understand that was the way people claimed territory at that time. So there were many different groups trying to reach this very strange place called the North Pole. And of course, Peary's nemesis, Mr. Cook, Frederick Cook, went up there in 1908 and traveled out on the ice just a certain distance and took some photographs with an American flag and came back and declared that he had reached the North Pole. And at the time, most people believed him. He was a very affable man. He was loved by Americans. He was more of a Democrat type person. Mm-hmm. He was a man of the people. He went to Denmark first so he could be declared the victor by the Danish royalty. He was clever enough to know that once royalty establishes you in Europe, at least at that time, that Americans would readily accept you. So he went there and came back to America, having Denmark claim that he was the winner of the North Pole run. And when he got to America, people believed him. When Peary reached the North Pole, he was so magnanimous. He was told that Peary had reached the North Pole in 1909. And Frederick Cook said, "Well, that's great. The pole is big enough for both of us." You see, whereas Peary said, this man is a liar, you know, and he was very angry. Well, the public didn't like Perry because they assumed that Perry was mean-spirited. Perry ran with big-time people. He was close to President Roosevelt. He was close to a lot of top-level people in government. So here was this man, a man of the people, saying he made it, and here was this mean-spirited man named Perry saying he didn't. And I think the person who summarized this controversy best was Peter Frocken, the famous Danish explorer, who said that Frederick Cook was a gentleman and a liar, and Perry was neither. So that gives you some idea of what Frocken felt about them. It turns out that Cook never thought that the Eskimos were, quote, credible witnesses. That was the term that was used then. Greeley, who lost all of his men, many of them to cannibalism and trying to reach the highest point or some of the highest points of the North, hated Peary for saying to him that he should have adopted some of the Eskimo ways, he would have made it. And Greeley used to say that Peary, too, had no credible witnesses because all he had were some Eskimos and an ignorant Negro. That's what he called Henson, which really hurt Henson very badly. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of stories about trying to reach the pole. But once the authorities such as Rasmussen and others listened to the Eskimo people, the two Eskimos, Apella and Atukashuk, who went out with Mr. Cook, they came back and said to Rasmussen, and they said, well, we don't know whether we made it to the North Pole or not. We don't know anything about this North Pole. But wherever Cook took us, there was always a big mountain right behind us. So there is no mountain within 500 miles or so of the North Pole. So it was quite clear that nobody ever listened to the Eskimos, who knew very well where they were. Mm-hmm. And whereas the Polar Eskimo Inuit people who went to the North Pole with Peary, and they were Igingwa, Okia, Siglu, and Uta, the great Uta, they were very credible witnesses, and when they reported to Rasmussen, Dr. Rasmussen, where they had gone, it was quite consistent with what Peary had said. So Rasmussen said the moment he heard Cook's story, he knew it was a scandal, whereas he knew that Peary was telling the truth. So there are all of these stories about who made it to the North Pole, and as recently as a few years ago, a man named Rawlins claims to have found new evidence and new formulas to show that Peary miscalculated and lied about where he was, that he never reached the pole. This made headlines in the Washington Post and articles by a man named Boyce Rensberger. And Boyce Rensberger and Rawlins claim to have this evidence now, and a series of front page articles appeared on the Washington Post about Peary faking his data, not making it to the North Pole. It was later found that the numbers that they had, they claimed to be formulae from Peary, that both Rawlins and Boyce Rensberger had, were serial numbers from the backs of his watches, his chronometers, and they had pretended that these were somehow formulae or something, and it was totally wrong. And now the latest photometric measurements by the prestigious Navigation Society and depth measurements that they made at the time they traveled up there all pretty much demonstrate quite clearly that they made it to the exact North Pole and should be credited for it.
And that's how you feel?
I feel very much that they made it. I've studied this so long, and I was never supporting either Cook or Peary. I simply didn't know. But once I looked at all the evidence, it was just so clear to me that not only did they make it, but they stood right there at the pole. And had they gone even 60 or 70 miles from the pole, I'm still willing to give it to them. If we give Balboa and Cortez theirs and Columbus America, I mean, we must give them the pole then for getting that close. But they, we believe, reached the pole. Now, there is some question as to who reached it first. And that was the toughest thing to research because there were four people who were of Eskimo background who were really making it possible for Peary and Henson to get there. Henson was the only man on the team who could speak the language. So he was the only one who could persuade the Eskimos to go. Many of the Eskimos quit much earlier. And you see, Peary had several other men on that trek. But when he got to the last leg of it, he said, Henson must go with me. I cannot make it without him. Bob Bartlett, for whom I think one of your buildings is named, Bob Bartlett admitted that he really wanted to go to the North Pole. He was very saddened when Peary told him that he had to turn around. So Peary took Henson and the four Eskimos, knowing that they could get him there. Peary could hardly walk. He had lost most of his toes. So they literally carried him there. And it is believed that when they got right to the North Pole, or just about there, that Peary tried his best to get the Eskimos to go on forward without Henson. They wouldn't.
So he could achieve the pole literally himself.
He really wanted to. Yeah. But then Henson took off while he was resting. The Eskimos told him this. And he went forward, and he arrived there, we're told, 45 minutes ahead of time. Peary was very angry with him for not following his command. Peary was the commander. That was fair. He should have stopped. And I do believe, from studying these men's personalities over the years, that when they arrived at the pole, Hinson said to him, "Every time you go back to America, I am your colored servant. While we're in the North, we are always equals. Mm-hmm. But every time you go back, you know, I'm nothing and you're something. But I want you to know, for the rest of your life, that the first person to stand here in this North Pole was this man you call your colored servant, Matthew Hinson. I'm convinced he did it." Perry was so angry with him all the way back. And Hinson later wrote about it. He said, "What did I do other than going to the pole with my boss?" Well, Hinson knew what he had done. You know, he had a sense of pride, you know. And in fact, many of the people whose diaries I found up there said it was a sense of arrogance. But what they call arrogant was the fact that they said, "He walks around strutting like he's a white man." You see, because the Eskimos respected him. And one of the doctors who kind of lost his mind up there said, "I don't believe the way this black man acts. He thinks he's white. And he even laughed at me, he and the Eskimos. How dare he laugh at me?" Well, the man was incompetent, so they were laughing at him trying to adjust. So I do think there was that moment between the two of them. And Hinson probably did go ahead without orders. And that accounts for the fact that Perry didn't speak to him all the way back to the ship. And I later found some letters in which Perry wrote the people who were paying him his salary, the rest of his salary, when he returned to America, saying, "Hinson is given to megalomania," Perry wrote, "and you have to talk to him," because so there was this great pride in Hinson, and I think it was because of that he went to the pole first.
What a complex relationship they must have had, these two.
Yes.
My goodness. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Dr. Alan Counter. Dr. Counter was educated at Tennessee University and then at Case Western, where he received his PhD. He also holds a Doctor of Medical Science, recently, I understand, from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. This is Conversations. We're talking today about the recognition of Matthew Hinson. The book is called North Pole Legacy, Black, White, and Eskimo, written by Dr. Alan Counter, published in 1991. It is the story not just of Matthew Hinson and of Robert Perry, but of the children they left behind in the North Pole when they made their final ascent on the pole. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. It is said that Matthew Hinson and Robert Perry made it to the pole because, as they would say in the argot, they went native. They learned how to walk, talk, think, and travel as the Inuit people did. From your research, this is also true. And it was Matthew Hinson who, in your mind, made sure that they got there, had the expertise?
When I looked at the early expeditionary notes and when I went to the archives to find the early diaries, one of the fascinating things that I found was that there was one man on the trip from Kentucky named Verhoef. And Verhoef hated two things. He hated the fact that Perry brought his wife along. He kept referring to her as the woman, saying she didn't belong there. It's all in his diary. It's in the archives if you'd like to see it. And he hated Matthew Hinson. He couldn't see why a black man should come along on such a trip. And occasionally he would fall asleep and not do his job, and Hinson would go out and do it for him, like make his measurements of tidal changes and so forth. And he hated Hinson for it. He would say, "That so-and-so would go out and read my tidal waves, and I was asleep. He should have told me to wake up and do it," but Hinson would do it for him. And the battles became so intense that Mrs. Perry once told them, "So why don't you go outside and just fight it out?" He was telling Hinson that black people shouldn't vote. How dare you talk about voting? So this became very intense. And one of the things that really came out of this was that not only was Hinson a very diligent and capable man who was doing all of these things, he was this man describing in his diary what he was doing, but he said, "Hinson is trying to go too native. He's out talking with these people all the time, and he's learning their language, and why would he do that? And he's even kayaking with them. And the other day he made a bet that he could kayak better than I could," and all that. And so you could see Hinson learning the culture. And Hinson was persuading Perry all the time that you've got to take these mosses and put in your shoes so your feet won't, you know, get injured. You've got to come out of those leather boots and those English tweeds, you know, and come in. So Hinson, early pictures show him. They had early Kodak cameras. They show Hinson dressing like the natives and sitting with them. And you read this man's diary, he's attacking him for it. So early on you see this persuasion. I think Perry quickly realized, being a very smart man, that that was really the only way to do it.
In Victorian times, so to speak, this was most unusual.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Most people would wear the standard tweeds. I mean, people like Scott and Amundsen, even after that, they were going to the South Pole wearing all these unusual, you know, this sort of British garb and so forth. But the point is, had they worn the native garb, they would have been much more successful in surviving that area. By the way, it was believed that black people could not tolerate that climate. There was even a bet made to Matthew Henson that he would lose all of his limbs, particularly his fingers and toes, from being in that climate. Many people believe that that was natural because black people belong in a more temperate climate. It appears that Peary lost, again, every one of his toes except the little ones on both feet. Henson never lost a fingernail.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Never lost anything.
So what he learned held well for him.
Very well. And he learned from the natives. He dressed like they did. He did everything they told him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was a fascinating man. He just sort of, and he learned their language, which is critical. He learned their language so fluently that in some of the writings I found, and quote in the book, I found Peter Froyken's papers. And Peter Froyken said, as he translated from the Eskimos, that they would say that whenever they met Matthew Henson, they felt very good because he spoke their language like an adult. But often they were happy that it was dark when they met the other men on Peary's expedition because they didn't want the men to see them laughing as they spoke their language like a child. Isn't that polite? They didn't want to laugh in public in front of the men as they tried to speak their language like children. But Henson spoke it like an adult.
The story of Matthew Henson is being told by Alan Counter around the United States, has been told here in Fairbanks, is told in the pages of North Pole Legacy as well. Dr. Alan Counter himself is a very well-traveled man. He's been several times to Greenland studying the history of Matthew Henson, Robert Peary, and of their children, the part Eskimo, part white, part Eskimo, and part black children left behind by Robert Peary and by Matthew Henson, which is in itself a story. He is the director of the Harvard Foundation for Intercultural and Race Relations, established by the president and the deans at Harvard in 1981. They invited Dr. Alan Counter to be its first director in 1981. He said he perhaps would stay for a couple of years. He is, in 1993, the current director of the Harvard Foundation. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. We're talking about a legacy left by Matthew Henson. How did you get interested in this man's children?
Well, like
child,
many people.
I should say.
Well, indeed, many people. Perhaps you've heard rumors about the fact that some of the explorers started killing them. I sat there listening. I thought that's not too unusual. There are a number of Danish people there, and maybe that's the Eskimo women. And then later they said they'd seen some Eskimos who were darker than others. I thought, well, that's very interesting. I wonder who could have been there that's very dark. And I just tucked it away in the back of my mind. And almost 10 years later, I decided that I wanted to pursue this. I was up there on a scientific mission, traveling around as I travel. I went around to different villages, and I came to one where they said there were Kalnaktuko people who were a little darker than others. And I asked to meet them, and I asked through this translator to take me there to the village and to this area. And when he took me over to this little igloo, as they call this small wooden house, a man walked out the door and looked at me. He was dark in complexion. He had curly hair. He just started laughing, and he grabbed my hair and pulled it and said, "You are Henson, and you've come here to find me."
It's a remarkable thing.
I know, and I was just astounded. I looked at him. I said, "No, I'm not a Henson, but are you in any way," and I was talking to a translator, "are you in any way related to Matthew Henson?" I was thinking if Matthew Henson had any relatives, it'd have to be like his great-grandchildren or something. Mm-hmm. And this man looked at me and said, "I am the son of Maripaluk." I just couldn't believe it. I was totally incredulous of this. I looked at my translator. I said, "What is he saying?" And they were both laughing. And I said, "Are you serious?" He said, "Yes, I am son of Maripaluk." And here I was staring at the son of Matthew Henson, the 81-year-old son. He looked to be no more than about 65. His skin was smooth. His hair was curly. He was clearly much darker than the other Eskimos. And I got to know this man. He was one of the most fantastic men I've ever met in my life. I spent so much time with him walking around the villages. He was loved by everyone. He had a laugh that was so infectious. And we would laugh together. And I just got to know him so well, and he said to me, "You ought to meet my cousin." I said, "Cousin?" He said, "Yes, I have a cousin." So I said, "Where is your cousin?" He said, "Well, if you go over these mountains and about 100 miles north and out to a little island called Kakikasat, you'll see my cousin. He is the son of Peary." So I said, you mean Admiral Peary has a son up here? He said, yes. I couldn't believe it, so I took off. I went over the mountains, out over to this little island across the bay called Kakirkasat. And running toward me was a little man whom I thought was white at first. As he came closer and closer, I realized that he was a man who was obviously of mixed background, mixed Eskimo background. And sure enough, he came to me smiling, and he pointed to me and said, you are a Henson. So he wondered, why would someone, again, who looks like me, come that far north unless I've been looking for my family? And there I got to know both men. And I tell you, they were just fascinating men as they told me about their lives, their backgrounds, everything about them and their desires. They had both grown up as, they call themselves cousins because they had grown up as cousins. They were adopted by two Eskimo brothers after their fathers left.
Each of whom married their mothers.
Each of whom married their mothers. And they grew up as real good friends, and they spent perhaps their first 15 years or so together. And so they were rather close. And then they parted to go to different parts with their parents, different parts of the areas of Greenland, of northern Greenland.
We're in the northern tip of Greenland?
Yes, we're out around Ita, which is fairly high up, around 78, I guess. And it's north of Thule Air Base. That's a good marker for it. Okay. North of Thule Air Base, and that's the area that Peary had lived in for a long time because he believed that you could walk from Greenland to the North Pole for a while until he and Matthew Henson demonstrated that Greenland was an island and not a continuous landmass directly to the North Pole. So they live up in that area, about 1,000 miles north of the Arctic Circle.
And from the photographs I saw, there are glorious windswept mountains and a long, deep valley that is snow-covered. Is it snow-covered year-round?
It is for most of the year, yes, indeed. There are some glaciers there, of course, that just remain as they are and have been for thousands of years. And there are areas, though, that will sort of become dry during the summer. And some of the villages are built along those areas.
Also, with the trying to again gain a picture for listeners, with the exception of rifles that I saw, for the most part, these people and their houses, for the most part, these people subsist as they have for at least hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Indeed, that's one of the things that the Danish people have tried to maintain since Denmark owns Greenland. They've tried to help them maintain their culture. They don't allow outsiders to come in there hunting. They only permit the native people to hunt. They are still wearing their polar bear pants, their sealskin boots, their sealskin tops, their anoraks. They're still making kayaks, sometimes out of skins, but often now out of canvas. Mm-hmm. But they still go out hunting narwhals as they've done for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So they've kept much of their culture intact. And it was fascinating to see this because I went out filming with them. They eat their foods raw still. They shoot seals and start to flint them right there and eat them raw. They have only dog teams and no snowmobiles when I was up there. So they travel around in a very natural state, and they really are resourceful. They use everything they find. Every little scrap of wood or metal they use in some very special way. And I just admired them so much when I learned about the cultures and how well they survive such environments.
These two men were... Is the word wrong to use great hunters? They were both of them accomplished hunters in their time?
They were not only great hunters, but it was fun to talk with them because one would say, this one was the greatest hunter of all times, about the other one.
Yes.
Then they'd say, oh no, you were the greatest hunter of all times. And oh, it was just delightful to hear the two of them. They were such good friends. But they were both hunters, and they said that was all they knew to do. They had not even last names. They didn't even use Henson or Peary until the missionaries came up and gave them their names in the late 60s, early 70s. So while they knew who they were, they simply did not use last names. And they were out hunting all the time. Many of them lose their hearing from hunting because they're firing these guns all the time.
One of the things you went up to do was to check on hearing loss.
Indeed, to study their sensory, neural, and nerve hearing loss, which is irreparable damage to the auditory system. Mm-hmm. But they were quite well adjusted in spite of that. I mean, they go on making a living, and they still hunt. And even at 81, they still had seal traps out that their sons had put out that they were looking for. Each of these two men had five children. Anelka Henson had five sons. He had a daughter earlier who died and another son earlier who died. He named his first son after his adopted father, mm-hmm. not Matthew Henson, which is interesting. His name was Kitla.
The man who'd raised him.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And so his five sons produced 22 grandchildren for him. Kari Peary had also five children, three daughters and two sons, and he had 19 grandchildren. And they were very proud. And they said to me, however, that they knew they were going to die soon. not long after I met them. They said, we're old and we're going to die soon. And since we were little boys, we've had one dream in life. And that dream was to visit the land of our fathers, just to reach out and touch a relative and hope that somebody would accept us. No relative has ever contacted us. And they said, and we'd also like to lay a wreath at our father's graves. Can you help us? Hmm. Well, of course, I didn't know what to say. I had no idea of how I could help them or whether I could help them. But what I realized was that if I could appeal to the U.S. military, I might be able to get a plane to fly them down from the top of the earth, literally, down to spots in America that were of significance to their fathers' lives. And sure enough, I managed to do that. I managed to, through a lot of letters, a lot of writing, and appealing and so forth, contact people who could help me do that. And I was able to bring the two 81-year-old sons and 10 of their children down to America to meet with their relatives for the first time. It was just a most moving experience.
What an accomplishment to bring them all down.
Well, I was very pleased to do that.
Now, the Hensons reacted, the American Hensons reacted very well, in fact, with some jubilation to the discovery of other relatives in the far north. The Perrys didn't react so well, with some discomfort and not really wanting to be interrupted. How do you account for the differences? Is it just these individuals, or is it something else?
Well, I think we have to start at the individual level first and just assume that it's that. It's so easy to try to suggest that it's a cultural difference, and that may be part of it. But the moment I contacted the Hensons or found them, mainly through telephone books and just calling around and asking in the area where Matthew Henson was born, the moment I made contact with them, the first reaction, the first response was, hallelujah, Uncle Matt has children. And in my book, I have a chapter entitled Hallelujah, because that word best symbolizes what the Hensons family, the black family, felt the moment they heard about family members. They said, can we send them food? Do they need blankets? Do they need, you know, they were just so, there was an outpouring of just love and really a desire to make a contact. And the other part of that chapter in the book, North Pole Legacy, is it's called Hallelujah/Not Interested, because the Perry family indicated that they were simply not interested in this. And they did question whether or not I had found legitimate relatives of theirs and so forth. Well,
no, so they wanted to know your motives. Why are you doing this? Alan
indeed,
Cowder?
They asked me that. That was a call I received in my office saying, why are you doing this? What is this all about? Why are you bringing all of this out? I had to assure them that I had no ulterior motives. My motives were quite clear, just to help Kari and his children make contact with their family, the American Perrys. They felt they had never been claimed, they'd always been abandoned. And perhaps I was naive to think that this would be done very easily. But it was not with the Perrys, and I think that that created a lot of sadness at that time.
Do you think that some of this is at least in part because Perry's accomplishments were under a cloud for so long? And my gosh, here comes another cloud.
I think that had a lot to do with it. I think the family is probably very sensitive to all of these accusations and challenges about making the North Pole and people trying to damage his credibility. In the past, there was a film about this North Pole journey in which Rod Steiger and I think Richard Chamberlain played the role of Cook, making it look as if Mr. Cook made it to the pole. Well, I think that kind of thing was very disturbing to the family, because we know for a fact that Cook never got within 500 miles of the pole, and no serious scholar ever really believed that. I mean, there are clubs and other groups, I think, that probably continue to support a successful journey to the pole by Cook just for the fun of it, but that has to be the only reason. So I think that was part of it. But I still think, though, that you have to overlook all of that. There's the human factor. Here was a member of one's family, and this person is certainly very old. You expect he will not live much longer. So it is important to make sure that he has that one wish, that connection. And I had no connection with the family. I simply wanted to try to help them accomplish their lifelong dream. And that was my only role in it. I had no need. I didn't want any money from them or anything. In fact, I'd used my savings to help pay for the trip. And when I ran out of money, I appealed to Mr. John H. Johnson of Ebony Magazine, Ebony and Jet, and he was kind enough to help me with some funds to help make the whole dream possible.
He's the publisher of Ebony and Jet.
Yes, yes. And he asked nothing for it. He just simply said, I'd be happy to help you. He was a friend of Matthew Henson's, you see.
Oh.
Yes.
First, let me interrupt only long enough to remind people of Alan Counter's book, he mentioned the chapter called Alleluia, Not Interested. It is from North Pole Legacy, published by the University of Massachusetts Press in 1991. It's the story not only of Matthew Henson and Robert Perry, their relationship and their trips to the pole, but it is the story of discovering and bringing the two men, the children of Matthew Henson and of Robert Perry, to the United States. It's a complicated story, a personal, intimate, sociologic, interesting expedition made by this man to Greenland and back again. Tell me how men who had been raised in the far north of Greenland and lived almost 80 years apiece there reacted to the kind of mad peculiarities of America. We have such a different culture than they lived in all their lives.
Well, they reacted very beautifully, very admirably, in fact. They were statesmen when they had to speak. They were just warm-hearted people when they met their families. Certainly, many of the sights and sounds of America were just absolutely astounding to them, but never overwhelming. I recall a scene where we were on the bus. We rented this huge bus to take the entire family to all the sites of significance to their fathers. And while we were on the bus, these cars were passing. And it's hard for us to imagine. They've never seen cars. So now a cop was going, look at this. They're like little birds. Look at them. They're going by us. Petty, 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 petty. He was going, they're like little birds. Then they get to New York. And they say, igloo, 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 quack, 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 pukee, which means so many igloos, you know. And they look at these buildings, and they say they look like the little holes in the cliffs above our villages where the birds live. There are people living in there, you know. And they were just astounded by the looks of the place. But the moment they looked at that, they were like anybody else. They would stop and say, how are you? I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me. They were so polite. I even took Anauka to the church in Harlem that his father belonged to. It was the Abyssinian Baptist Church, which is one of the most respected and famous in the country. The Reverend Samuel Proctor was the minister, and he had a special service in their honor. And they asked an Alcock to stand, and the audience of about 1,000 on that Sunday morning applauded him. Mm-hmm. Then the minister, Reverend Proctor, said, will you please come up and speak? An Alcock went up, and he was as eloquent as any statesman. He got up and he thanked them for inviting him to the church of his father. He said, I'm just an ordinary person from so far away, but I thank you for inviting me here today. It means a lot. Mm-hmm. He ended by saying, Kuyana, thank you, and sat down. And then the church embraced Robert Peary's son. So the black community embraced the Peary's like they were family, and they had him stand, and they applauded him. It was just very moving to see that everywhere he went. And finally, Robert Peary's Amereskimo son, and I say Amereskimo, meaning he's really part American, part Eskimo. His father was an American military man serving abroad, so and technically he's American.
They were born on the ship.
They were born on the ship also, so technically they could be called Americans. But his son was so proud. He said to me, the people here, the Kalnaktuko people, and the black people, they treat me like I'm a family member. They treat me so nicely. There's mm-hmm. something special about them, he kept saying. And he felt so proud to be a part of them. So it was really a very moving thing to see this. Everywhere we went, the two of them together, adjusting, talking to people, feeling at home, meeting family members, and just hugging. And it meant so much to them to be able to do that.
Has this been an extraordinary adventure for you as well?
It's been an incredible adventure. When one takes on a project like this, it's hard to ever imagine that it'll unfold in this way. I mean, this was simply a trip to Greenland that turned out to be an opportunity to help someone fulfill a lifelong dream. And then from there to find that there was widespread interest in it. It's also taught me a lot about people. There were people of every imaginable background, color, religion, race that helped me on this project. And no one ever said no. That was all the way to the President of the United States. That was the interesting thing about it. The moment I walked to them and said, I'm trying to help two older Eskimo men to achieve, and they was, what do you want? Basically was what they said. I mean, people were really very helpful all along. Mm-hmm. And I remember the president of Harvard, President Derek Bach at that time, saying to me, this story moves me so much. He said, I really like it. He said, I just can't believe it. It's so fascinating. He said, how can I help you? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I would like to host a banquet for these men to welcome them to America and to welcome them to Harvard. He said, you've got it. I said, well, what I'd also like to do is to give them awards, the kind of recognition we give people, you know, even heads of state who come to visit us. He and the University Marshal and others said, fine, we'll be happy to do it for you. We had this beautiful 200-person banquet with faculty, students, Nobel laureates, members of the community, and Hinson and Peary family members, mainly Hinson family members, but we did talk a few of the Peary family members into coming to this banquet. Robert Peary III came and brought his son Robert Peary IV. And just before they were leaving the country to go back home, I managed to talk Mrs. Robert Peary Jr., the 83-year-old wife of the 83-year-old surviving son, Robert Peary Jr., in Augusta, Maine. I was able to talk her into permitting Kari to meet his brother. The moment she said yes, you could do it, because everybody had said no until that time. And we didn't expect he'd ever meet any of his relatives. The moment she said yes, I jumped on the bus with a group of my students from Harvard, and they were all so happy because they had become so pained by the way he was being treated that they had just sort of encircled him, and they had become a family. And these were white students and black students and Hispanic students that all just become his family. And they wouldn't let anybody get close that they thought might hurt his feelings or anything. Well, we got on this bus, we drove to Augusta, Maine, and pulled this huge Greyhound-like bus right into their yard. He got off, he saw his brother for the first time, they shook hands, they spent the day going around the house, looking at different artifacts from the Peary era. They looked at the player piano that was on the ship when they were both born, actually. They looked at all of the different Greenlandic artifacts, and Kali would explain to Robert Peary Jr. what they really were, which gave him a chance to have some authority. And at the end of the day, the two brothers were out on the yard as we were about to leave. They shook hands again, and Kali looked at his American brother, whom he had never seen before, and said, "For the first time in my life, I feel like a Peary." And that was such a moving moment. And so his brother just looked at him and said, "Oh." That's all he ever said. And we left. And that was the first and only time he'd ever seen his brother in all these years.
Quite a moment.
Yes.
Quite a moment. Dr. Alan Counter is with us on Conversations, telling the story of the Peary's and the Hinsons. Let me introduce in some other ways. Dr. Counter's research currently, as I understand it, is clinical and basic research on nerve and muscle physiology, nerve and physiological diagnosis of brain-damaged children and adults. Tell me about the research you've been doing with hearing-impaired people.
Well, we've conducted a number of studies, both in Cambridge at Harvard and in Stockholm at the Karolinska Institute in the laboratory of Professor Erik Borre, who's one of Sweden's top authorities in the area of auditory physiology. We have explored the impact or the effect of gunshots, military-type guns or hunting guns with the Eskimos, on hearing. We find, for example, that most of the Eskimo men that we've been studying develop hearing loss as early as 10 to 15 years of age. These are severe sensory, neural, and nerve hearing losses that can't be corrected. Well, there we can go in and study the cochleas to see what kind of hair cell damage takes place. And incidentally, we've tried to create a small hearing conservation effort so that they can wear special plugs that they can put in just before they fire the gun and pull out very easily under their anorak so that it won't disturb the hunting. But this is one type of study that we're doing. We've also looked at the use of the electromagnetic fields for giving facial nerve stimulation, people with Bell's palsy and other conditions. And in this type of work, there is a magnetic stimulator that is often held just right above the ear in doing this. And it generates a very rapid, in microseconds, pulse. And it's so rapid that the ear doesn't hear it very well. But if you slow it down, it is as high in intensity as some gunshots. So it's damaging the ear when people don't even realize it. So the person could be becoming deaf while they're being stimulated for facial nerve therapy or for facial nerve analysis or diagnosis. So we've uncovered this difficulty, this problem, and we've explained it to the manufacturers. And in many cases now, earplugs are being given to patients who are using this, or they've modified the instrument itself. So that's another level. And also, we know now that through electrical stimulation, you can cause regeneration in nerve fibers, and there have been some studies to show that in some nerves, some peripheral nerves, you can cause regeneration through magnetic fields in fibers that have been damaged, nerve fibers that is. And so we're beginning to try to find if we cannot generate electromagnetic fields in the area of the ear hopefully to reestablish neural contacts or see if we can't generate or cause some regeneration in nerve fibers. We're still in the process of developing it, but that's what we've been doing for the last number of years. And so that is sort of the future of our research.
An exciting opening door.
Oh, it is indeed. But what we have done thus far is to clearly demonstrate that if you use electromagnetic fields, people who are deaf can often hear sounds from these magnetic fields, one. And then two, that if you take a normal hearing person and put this magnetic device near their ear, if it's not properly encapsulated, it will cause very high intensity, short impulse noise, sort of like a gunshot, but about like half the time, and that could be damaging to ears. So that's the sort of work we were doing. But the Eskimo hunters were fascinating to us because they hunt for a lifetime. The women tend not to have hearing loss. Some of the women who go hunting with them might very well, but most of the men have hearing losses.
Dr. Alan Counter with us on Conversations. I want to take some of the time we have left and ask you about the Harvard Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And in part because of the perspective, the seat, if you will, it gives you from which to view race relations on campus and race relations in this nation. What kind of work has the foundation done to help people, as Rodney King said, get along?
Well, first of all, I think the name Harvard Foundation is an unusual name for an effort, or an institute, or an agency that is designed to bring about intercultural and racial understanding, which is what it's established for. The committee that of faculty and students, along with the president that established this agency, felt that rather than creating separate buildings and isolated centers for students, that there should be something a little unique at Harvard, that is. Perhaps centers might be good for other places, and it depends on the community and whether they work. But they wanted to establish something that they call a sort of foundation of trust, a foundation of understanding and interaction among peoples of different backgrounds. Now that is not as simple as it sounds, because initially this effort, as I saw it when I was appointed director and asked to really develop this amorphous structure into something that could be very effective, and as I spoke with students and faculty about what it is they wanted, what it was that they wanted at the time, what kind of changes they wanted to see the university take on, I learned a lot, and I tried to create this around the desires of our students and faculty. Basically, it was that there was no opportunity for expression among many people of the university, a university that had been largely all white male for many years, had become now male and female, and it began to bring in people of different races, persons of African American background in particular. And that all took place primarily right after Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. There was a real concerted effort then to include minorities of color, especially Black Americans. Previous to that, there had always been Black Americans, some Asian Americans, some Hispanic Americans, and very few in number. Well, this was the main effort, and all of a sudden, Harvard went from having maybe 3 or 4 or 10 African American students in a class to roughly 100 in a class of about 1,200 to 1,500. So this brought about some changes in 68, and here we were in 1981 seeing a larger number of African American, Asian American, Hispanic American, both of Puerto Rican and Chicano backgrounds, mm-hmm. and Native Americans coming to Harvard. And I saw myself as helping the university adjust to this growing diversity. We put together a number of programs. First of all, there is the issue of simply cultural recognition. Most people take it for granted that the people who are most often recognized or given opportunities for presentations at universities are white, and most often they're male. And they simply take it for granted that that's the way it is.
Sure.
Well, previous to my taking over this institute, that was the pattern at Harvard. And among the first things that I did with the institute was to put on a program by bringing a presidential commission to Harvard to talk about wartime and relocation and internment of Japanese American citizens. Well, this brought about meetings of scholars who were white, Hispanic, Asian, otherwise, who had an interest in this topic. So it brings students together, faculty together around an educational topic. And this is how we started with a number of programs such as this. We worked with student organizations to have representatives from all of the student organizations on our board, as well as interested faculty members. We brought faculty and students together like they had never been. We brought individuals to the university who could talk about ways of interacting. Most of the faculty simply looked out in the classroom when they saw a minority person. They may have seen this person as a little bit different. not like themselves. They'd gone to school there at the university when the classes were largely all white. Mm-hmm. We had to get them to kind of adjust a little bit to that, to talk to them, maybe create special meetings so they could chat with the students about how they felt about things. In other words, creating or improving opportunities for better intercultural and racial understanding. And finally, we saw that people of just about every race, culture, background, and religion would come to us saying, here's what we'd like to do. This would help us, we think, create better understanding on our campus. And my task was to mold those different programs into university-wide programs so that we wouldn't need a separate building. We found that the university museums had never exhibited Native people's art, only European art. Why couldn't we exhibit Native people's art? Why do they need a special building for that? No, I said to our president, we must have an exhibit of Native people's art too, mm-hmm. and of African American art, as well as European art. The Irish Cultural and Historical Society reminded me that there was a time when Harvard was very prejudiced toward Irish, that many of the Irish people, including John Kennedy, were, they said, forced to live in one house, and they said it was Winthrop House. They wanted to do something. They wanted to have a better understanding of the aspirations and interests of people of Irish background. Well, I brought John Hume from Northern Ireland to talk about the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, but not just for Irish community people, but for people from the black community, people from the Asian community. And students came out and they were astounded to hear this man, John Hume, member of parliament, say, we really had no civil rights movement until we saw a man named Martin Luther King carrying a sign saying we shall overcome. Huh. We took on that pattern. So it brings Irish and black students together. I remember one day in my office seeing the head of the Irish Cultural Society, Sean Brady, and Camille Holmes, head of the Black Students Association, embracing each other. And I said, we've, you know, come a long way.
This is working.
So, absolutely. So it's this kind of program that we put on. That's just a small part of it. It's hard to explain all of it. It's called cultural recognition. We try to make sure that everyone is recognized and appreciated. And the last thing I'd like to say is that annually, we bring all of our faculty together, our students. We ask them to wear costumes. They dress up. If you're from Scotland, you wear a Scottish costume. Mm-hmm. We do anything we can to get the people together. And we have a huge day called a cultural festival and fair. We have foods from every culture on campus, every background, every religion. We have Arab students, we have Jewish students come together, and they dance. Well, they must put on a performance, they must have food from their culture. And this brings the entire campus together.
This is, what I'm hearing you say is that this process of creating inclusion is small step by small step by small step.
Yes, yes, it is indeed. But it works, and people like it, and they want to be respected, they want to be connected. Of course, there are occasionally problems. You know, there are people who challenge each other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some of the young people who think they're a little smarter than other young people can get out of hand. I'd say 95% of our students are the finest you'll find anywhere, just like in most universities. You have about 5% that are difficult sometimes because of their strong feelings and beliefs, and sometimes they're totally wrong mm-hmm. and don't want to admit it. But you have to work with them as well.
Alan Counter, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for sharing this hour with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Alan Counter, professor of neuroscience at Harvard University, author of two books, one of which is North Pole Legacy, a very readable and enjoyable story of his travels to Greenland and the people he brought home. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'll talk to you again next week.